Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs in the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stocks.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro-Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. This is Peter Schiff with another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. It is Wednesday, April 22nd, 2009. Basically, over the week, you know, we've finally had a pullback in the stock markets. I think the Dow is back below 7,900. We're maybe 300-400 points off the high. And it's interesting that during this bear market rally, many, many people have become bullish on the market. Many people think the low is in. In fact, most of the bearishness that was out there, I think, has been replaced by bullishness. There's not that many people now who seem to think that the market's going lower, which probably means that it is going lower and that it will make another new low. And I've always been very suspicious of this rally. I still think there's some support in the Dow around the 7,500 level. And if it holds that level, maybe this will be a more meaningful bear market rally. But I think it's a bear market rally regardless of how long it lasts. But there is a chance that we will roll over right here. You know, part of the optimism was that things were turning around in the economy, that things were turning around in the banking sector. None of that is happening. You know, a lot of the banks have been coming out with better-than-expected earnings, and that has caused people to be very optimistic. But interestingly enough, most of the banking stocks had rallied those better-than-expected earnings, and now that those earnings are coming out, the bank stocks are now declining again. The financials are under pressure. And as I, you know, speculated initially, I thought that most of the bank earnings were accounting tricks, were gimmicks, were not to be believed. And, of course, it turns out that that is precisely what happened. I mean, first of all, a lot of the earnings that are being reported by the financials are the result of trading revenue. This is not, you know, reliable or recurable revenue. This is, you know, one-time gains. I mean, you don't know. This is, you know, this is they bet right and they won. They made money gambling with their own money. It's not, you know, their revenues from their core businesses such as asset management, investment banking, mergers and acquisitions, all that stuff is down. They're making some money trading. But actually, it turns out, I read a report that one of the reasons some of these banks made money trading is because AIG deliberately put through some rather significant trades at losses for themselves because they needed to generate more losses in order to get more money from the U.S. government, which, again, is the moral hazards that we get when the government comes in and subsidizes companies for losing money. Obviously, the incentives are now reversed, where companies don't have an incentive to make a profit. They could do better generating losses because now they get more government money, and now, of course, they can pay themselves bigger bonuses or bigger salaries. Also, what we found out, and as I suspected, you know, earnings at companies like Wells Fargo that got everybody excited with their pre-announcement, you know, forget what day it was, of better-than-expected earnings, as it turns out, 100% of those earnings, it came from accounting changes where they no longer had to mark their securities to market. So what happens is Wells Fargo was able to pretend that some of the assets on its books, some of their toxic mortgages, they were able to pretend that they had more value than what they were claiming in the past. And so let's say they had to write their assets down by $10 billion because that's what the new market value was. They're able to write them back up and say, well, you know, we didn't really lose $10 billion. We only lost $5 billion. So that new $5 billion that they've now recovered based on their new accounting rules, well, now that gets counted as earnings in this current quarter because, they're, you know, it was a loss in the past, and now by marking them higher, they take that difference and apply it to earnings. So pretty much all of their earnings can be attributed to this accounting change, which is exactly what I thought. You know, when they originally released their numbers, I said, I'm sure a lot of it has to do with the accounting and where they mark their assets, and that's exactly what's happened. So it's all a farce, fantasy, that the banking sector is healthy and is turning around. And, of course, you know, you've got some of these banks that want to return the TARP money. And, you know, a lot of them probably can't return the TARP money. You know, I think some of them have said that they can't return it. But I think a lot of banks want to pretend that they want to return the money, but probably behind the scenes they can't afford it. But certainly they look stronger if they say, we want to give this money back. But, you know, a lot of them probably can't, or if they do give it back, they're ultimately going to fail at some point anyway. But I think between now and failure, maybe they want to be free to be able to bonus themselves additional money, and maybe they can't do that as long as they're on government life supports, and maybe they can pay themselves some big bonuses and then get new money from the government once they fail. But the financial sector is still in a shamble. Now, the government is coming up with these stress tests now, and they're going to try to make everybody feel good once they release the results of these stress tests, and I'm sure the stress tests are going to show that the banks are in much better shape than people think. Of course, the only reason that that's going to be the case is because the stress tests are going to be rigged. I mean, the stress tests are not going to really have an adequate amount of stress. So I don't think they're going to be testing these banks under realistic worst-case scenarios. I think they will be using much more rosy scenarios of what the government thinks is going to be the worst case. In fact, I'm trying to do a little research now to pull up some of the assumptions. I've read some articles on some of the assumptions that are being made by the government for the budget, for Barack Obama's budget. And even though we are, you know, estimating enormous budget deficits during the Barack Obama presidency of, you know, almost $2 trillion for the first year, and you know, and even by the end of his presidency, the last year, you're still looking at deficits of $1 trillion a year. The way that they get the deficits that small, you know, and they're obviously not small, is by assuming, you know, rather vibrant economic growth during the majority of his term, which is just obviously not going to happen. You know, I'm reading articles now on my website today from Bloomberg just showing that how the deficits, you know, that so far this fiscal year, I think we're already at $1 trillion. You know, the year is not even, I think it's half over. And the deficit is just running out of control. Because not only is government spending going through the roof, but tax receipts are plunging through the floor. I mean, people are losing their jobs. And when you lose your job, you're not paying taxes. The people that still have their jobs are earning less money, particularly a lot of the high-income people. Nobody is getting you know, no one's paying capital gains taxes on anything because everything has gone down. So the government's income tax revenues, its receipts, are shrinking, and its expenses are going through the roof. Not only the new programs that have been authorized and all the new spending and all the new bailouts, but all those counter-cyclical safety nets, you know, I put the word safety nets in quotes, that are kicking in as the economy slows, as people lose their jobs. But even as this is all happening, the only reason that the budget deficit is not going to be even bigger, according to the government, is based on their phony assumptions. So it's very easy for the government to create a sense of optimism based on the assumptions they make. So I'm sure in the case of what they project the budget to be, they're baking in, you know, rosy assumptions. And I'm sure when these stress tests are done, the assumptions being made are not going to be that stressful for the banks. And even then, you know, I'm sure they're going to, you know, find ways to make it appear that these banks are solvent. The last thing the government is going to do is do a bunch of stress tests and then say, we got bad news, all the banks failed the stress test, they're all going to go out of business. There's no way the government's going to do that. So the government's going to orchestrate some kind of PR campaign to try to put its seal of approval on these institutions by saying, hey, we ran them through these vigorous stress tests, and all but here's a couple of small little banks that didn't make it. Maybe they'll do something for show to try to create a false sense that everything is okay. You know, it's also interesting. I noticed that the Congress is in the process of passing this bill aimed at, you know, cracking down on the credit card companies for the fees that they charge and for the rates of interest that they charge, trying to put a cap on credit card interest and the fees. And it's interesting because some of the higher interest rates that the government finds objectionable is when the credit card companies adjust your interest rates based on an enhanced level of risk. So if, for example, you have a credit card and even though you're current, let's say based on credit reporting, I'm noticing that you're running up much bigger debts on your other credit cards, or you know, some circumstances are changing, and I've determined that you're a higher credit risk, I'm going to assess you with a higher rate of interest. The government doesn't want that to happen. The government doesn't want the credit card companies basing interest charges on an assessment of risk, which is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, obviously, that's what they have to do because they're taking more risk. If they see a situation where they perceive a greater risk of default, then the only way that they can maintain the profitability of those types of loans is by charging higher rates of interest to the people who are in that higher risk category. Now, obviously, it's not fair to the people who keep paying, but that ends up compensating the banks for the people who don't pay. But in the beginning, the bank doesn't know which of these higher risk people are going to fall delinquent. They just have to charge everybody in that pool of higher risk people a higher rate of interest to try to preserve the profitability of that business. What the government's going to do, if the government's going to come in and say, you can't do this, right? You can't charge people who are showing higher risk, higher rates of interest, then basically what the banks would have to do is not loan any money to any of these people, which probably wouldn't be a bad thing, but it's going to, you know, produce the opposite of what the government wants. The government is saying, it's not fair that you charge people in this higher risk category a higher rate of interest. Well, and this is, of course, done to theoretically help these people. Well, what the only solution would be in the market would be, okay, then we can't loan money to these people at all. If we can't price it according to the higher risk, then we're not going to take the risk because we can't do it profitably. So what it ends up is, as the government's trying to help people get credit, they're actually going to deny them that credit, which, as it turns out, is probably a good thing. And so the government is maybe, by this legislation, which I don't approve of, but it might actually work to restrict consumer credit, which actually would be a positive thing for the economy, only this is not what the government is hoping to achieve. Now, maybe if the government comes in and then says, no, you can't do this, you can't deny credit to these people, I mean, that makes no sense, or, you know, it's impossible. So it's going to have to achieve the opposite purpose. But it shows when the politicians, you know, here they are, they want to criticize the credit card companies for trying to identify riskier behavior and try to either raise the fees or try to protect themselves. But that's the reason that we're in a financial crisis. Of course, one of the reasons is because the banks weren't doing that. The banks were too restless. The banks weren't paying enough attention to assessing risk. And now here you have banks trying to make the cost of assuming risks, they need the revenues to offset the costs. And now the government says, no, we don't want you to do that. We don't want you to do that. We want you to keep lending money to people to buy things. And if it appears that their risk profile has enhanced, we want you to ignore that. We don't want you to do anything about it. We want you to keep lending money to people who are obviously, based on your methods of looking at it, engaged in risky borrowing and are at a heightened risk of not paying back. We don't want you to do anything about it. I mean, it just shows how crazy, you know, when you listen to Barack Obama and you listen to him talk, and he talks about the need to go away from a credit card economy and maxed out credit cards, and we need to go away from borrowing and spending. We need a real economy. We can't have a phony economy built on stock market appreciation and Wall Street speculation, all the good things that he says to try to make you believe that he understands the problem. And then all the policy, everything that he's proposing, and of course Barack Obama is behind this credit card bill. I mean, he's going to sign it, and he's actually making it worse or proposing worse language to it. everything he does is supposedly aimed at making it easier for Americans to do exactly what he says they shouldn't do. All of his policy is, how can we get credit flowing? Let's give tax breaks to people who go out and buy new cars. You know, let's make it easier for people to take out loans. Let's try to make it easier for people to borrow and spend on their credit cards. Well, why would you want to do that? Why would you want to encourage that when you're making all these speeches about why that's the problem, about why that's no good? And I guess, again, it all boils down to the fact that the thinking is, yes, we want people to save more. We want them to spend less, just not right now. We know that that's a good thing, but just not now. Because if they stop spending now, then the economy is going to fall apart. That is nonsense. That is nonsense. That's like saying, yes, I know that having a healthy diet is good, and I know that exercising is good. I just don't want to start that right now. I want to stuff my face and, you know, because I don't want to deal with it now. I don't want to deal with the consequences of having to deny myself the junk food that I like to eat. I don't want to have to get on that treadmill. You know, to say that savings is good, but not now, that borrowing on your credit card to buy things you can't afford is bad, but it's not bad right now, that's all nonsense. Because, again, what they're trying to do is say, hey, wait a minute, but we've got this phony economy, and if we stop spending and borrowing, the phony economy is going to collapse. So we need to keep the phony economy going. It makes no sense. And if you're saying, well, we're just going to do it now, we're just going to keep borrowing and spending until we get out of this mess, and then as soon as we get out of the mess, then we're going to do the right thing. Well, it doesn't work because we make the mess bigger. By going deeper into debt, we're in a bigger hole. We've got a bigger problem. So why do we have to make the problem bigger before we can solve it? Right? That makes no sense. It makes sense to solve it now while it's smaller. Right? Making it bigger in the name of making it easier to solve makes no sense whatsoever except in the mind of a politician or apparently a Keynesian economist. But what it really boils down to is the politicians are saying, you know what? We got an election in 2 years or a year and a half, and we don't give a damn. We don't want to be the bearers of bad news. We don't want to tell the American public that they're going to have to sacrifice, that they can't get a new loan, they can't buy that new car. We don't want to tell them that. We want to tell them what they want to hear. We want to tell them that we can spend our way out of this mess, that if you just go back to the mall and buy more stuff, that's how we recover the economy. Because it's all politics to them. That's the only way that this can make sense. It does, you know, if you look at the rationale, there is no other rationale. It's all short-term gain. Who cares about the long-term pain? You know, I mentioned that op-ed article. I forget if I did it on the radio show or on my video blog, where Mencken, yeah, it was on my video blog, Professor Mencken over at Harvard. And I guess, you know, I can't figure all this out because I didn't go to Harvard, you know, so I don't have the benefit of a Harvard education. But he's at Harvard, and he worked in the Bush administration, and he wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times that what we need is negative interest rates because we need more spending. And so what the Fed should do is create a lot of inflation to punish people for saving so that people won't want to save. They'll want to spend because they know that if they save their money, they're going to lose it to inflation. And that's what we need. And that's what's going to get the economy going. We need more spending, and inflation is what's going to encourage it. And it's just complete nonsense. And I wrote a little reply that the New York Times accepted, and they're going to be running it. I'm not exactly sure what issue it is, but they're going to run my rebuttal to his piece. But that is the crazy thinking in Washington, that we need to spend, that there's no way out of this mess but spend, and they don't understand that we got into this mess by spending. We're not going to get out of it by spending, right? When you dig a hole, you don't get out of it by digging it deeper. You got to fill it back up. You got to do the opposite of what you did. So if the problem is we spent too much, we got to spend less. If we didn't save enough, we got to save more. If we didn't produce enough, we got to produce more. You know, we got to export more. We got to import less. We've got to do the opposite of what we did to get into trouble. But according to the government, we got to do more of what we did to get us out of trouble. You know, we recklessly spent and borrowed money to get into this mess. And if we just keep recklessly borrowing and spending, then somehow we're going to miraculously get out of it. It's all complete and utter nonsense. Anyway, let me go to the phones. I know we got a bunch of people holding on. Let me take John in New York.
Hey, Peter.
Hey, John, how are you?
Hey, it's an honor to talk to you on your show. I noticed in the beginning you were talking about the tax receipts being down, and I got a quote from the CEO of Nationwide Tax Relief, and he was saying that delinquent taxpayers, at least for them, I think, is up 280%. And I just find that to be amazing, and when I think about that, I think, you know, we've had all these bailouts, we've had all this money spent, and, you know, when is it going to come time that we're going to have to start bailing out entire states, like on a much larger level than we've been doing now?
Well, look, I mean, we don't have to bail out anybody, but unfortunately the government's going to do it. I mean, that's one of the crazy things. When you look at how weak the economy is, what has already happened, and on top of that, we've done all these bailouts, we've cranked the deficit through the roof, think about where we'd be if the government hadn't done all this stuff, and realize that by doing it, you know, we're not out of the woods. We're just in deeper trouble. We've just postponed it a little bit and made it worse. So whatever, you know, whatever we're experiencing now, this is all artificial. We're going to have a much worse collapse once, you know, the effects of the bailouts and the stimulus, when it wears off, and all we're left with is more debt and a weaker economy, because that's what the government is doing. We are trading, you know, some short-term gain for long-term pain, but the long-term pain is not 10 or 20 years ago from now. I mean, it's soon. I mean, maybe it's in 6 months. But, you know, things are just proceeding more slowly than they should. But, of course, the longer this thing takes to play out, the worse it's going to be.
Yeah, I completely agree. I don't understand how we've gotten to the mentality where we think that somehow everyone's entitled to some kind of bailout. Another quick question. I remember hearing all this talk about this Geithner plan, where investors would be matched by the Treasury and have the Fed pick up the rest when buying, I guess, these toxic assets, supposedly, from the bank. And I got this interesting commentary. This guy was talking about, he was describing a situation where banks could borrow money from the government, or just use whatever money they've already gotten, and loan it to some special purpose entity that could then buy the asset from them. And I was just wondering if you had heard anything about that, or where the Geithner plan is. I haven't heard much about it recently.
No, they're still working on this plan where they'll, you know, these private partnerships, government and companies working together to buy this. I mean, none of this stuff is going to work. It is impossible for it to work. The only thing that would work is to let the market function, to let the market sort it out. We have a huge market. There are plenty of buyers, potential buyers, sellers. It's a global market. The mess would be sorted out. There'd be a lot of losses. A lot of people would have to discover that assets are worth a lot less than they thought. Companies might fail. But we would have an efficient reallocation of resources. We would reprice assets to real market levels. Insolvent companies would go out of business. Their resources would be freed up. More solvent companies could thrive in this environment. You know, the market would clear. It would correct itself. But when the government comes in and interferes and tries to micromanage it from Washington, D.C., it can't work because they're not that smart. Nobody is that smart. Nobody can figure it out. And, of course, it all becomes a political boondoggle anyway. Everybody's got their hand in this gigantic, you know, money pot now. Anyway, thanks for the call. I think I might have lost you. Let me go to Todd in Georgia.
Hey, Peter.
Hey, Todd, how are you?
Hey, good. I'm one of your customers down in Atlanta.
Hey, yeah, I've got a question. I'm going to be down in Florida, in Orlando. I'm speaking at the annual CFA conference. So I'll be down there on Monday and Tuesday of next week. But I will be back in time to do the show again next Wednesday.
Oh, great. Hey, I've held the belief that that gold is going to go up in price as soon as the bond market implodes, because I see inflation going through the roof at that point. Every time they ask Bernanke about inflation, he kind of gets this wry look on his face, like he knows something that we don't. And I read this article on the Street.com today, and they speculated that the Fed is going to ask Congress for this new regulation authority to make new Fed security to pull all that cash back out of the banks. And as I was reading that article, I was thinking, well, if they're going to make the banks buy a new security, how does that help the situation if they're still clogged up with all these new securities and can't, and if they're illiquid?
I don't know. Look, you know, all these are things that are one government gimmick after another to make believe that there's a cure, to make believe that we can get out of this mess. We can't. I mean, the bottom line is, you know, you've got all these toxic assets. Why are they toxic? They're toxic because the Americans who borrowed money can't pay it back. And no matter what the government does, it's not going to change that. Americans are broke. They borrowed trillions of dollars and spent the money. They can't pay it back. They don't have the assets to pay it back. They don't have the incomes to pay it back. They don't even have the desire to pay it back. I mean, look at what's going on. I mean, look at my own example. I mentioned this about with my mother. Now, my mother now is living, she's moving, out of this house that I rented. I think we move in about 2 more months. I bought this house down there in the same complex. But we leave in about 2 months when the lease is up. The landlord will have now had about 10 months of mortgage-free living, where she collects $6,000 a month rent from me and puts it in her pocket and gives nothing to the bank. She's going to move into this property because she's actually told my mother, I'm not going to renew your lease. I want you out of the property that I'm not even making any mortgage payments on. And this woman is going to move back in to this property with her husband, who is like works for the government. Her husband is like the fire chief of one of the towns down there in Florida, the chief of the fire department. They're going to move back into this house where they haven't made a single mortgage payment in close to a year. And they're still going to not make mortgage payments. And then they're going to tell the banks, hey, we need a modification because we can't afford to make this mortgage payment because look at what our income was. Meanwhile, they had a tenant that was living in that building who was making a rental payment that exceeded the mortgage. So she had all the money. She had all the means to make the payment, but she didn't want to. She took the money, and she basically kicked us out, saying, I don't want you as a tenant anymore because I'm going to be able to get a free house from the government. I'm going to move back into this house and plead poverty. I mean, and I've read other articles now that confirming where how many people are lying, how people are, quitting jobs, which is what I said they would do, or they're having, the banks call their company, but not talk to their real boss, talk to their friend, and their friend will say, yes, this person only makes $30,000 a year, or we're about to lay them off, when that's not the case. I mean, people are lying. I read one story where one of the things people are doing is getting divorced. Let's say you're married, and you have two houses, right? A primary house and a vacation house. Well, you can't get a modification on your vacation house. You can only do your principal residence. So if you're a married couple, you get divorced. And one person says, I live in... Now each person has their own residence that they can't make the mortgage payments on, and now they get modifications. I mean, the whole thing, it was a bad situation that the government has made worse, so these assets are going to collapse in value, and there's nothing the government can do to change those circumstances. There is no magic bullet. There is a huge, huge price that we have to pay for a multi-trillion dollar national spending orgy. I mean, it's no different. It's like any family. If you just decide that you're gonna go and just spend all the money you have in the bank, spend all your IRAs and your retirement money, cash in all your insurance money, spend your pension, and just go out and spend it on booze and women and having a big party, when you're finished spending all the money and it's all gone, there are consequences. You can't just pretend it didn't happen, right? And that's what we did as a nation. And there are consequences, and the government can't wish it away with some combination of fancy programs and agencies and gimmicks with all these weird acronyms and say, aha, this is the solution. Right? There is no miracle cure.
So you don't see any plausible way of mopping up that excess liquidity in the banks that Bernanke says he can do and to avert a...
Of course not. It's all just talk. Because how is he going to... He's basically saying, I can pump in all this extra money. I can keep interest rates really low. I can print a lot of money. I can get people even more indebted than they were before, right? I can get them even more addicted to cheap money. But then if we start to see prices starting to rise, I'm going to quickly take away all that cheap money. No, he's not. If he's going to do that, then why just put the cheap money in there in the first place? Because what he's saying is, I'm going to make the problem bigger, and then I'm going to solve it. Because if he does what he says he's going to do, I'm going to withdraw the stimulus. Well, now it's worse. We've got even more debt. We've got a bigger problem. So he's full of it. If he's going to administer the tough medicine, why not administer it right now? Why let the disease get worse and then administer it when it's going to be even more painful? It's all he's just saying what he has to say. Because if he told the truth, well, no, we're just going to let the inflation run out of control, then the dollar would collapse right now. So he has to lie. But people have to be smart enough to see through it and understand that, of course, he's lying. He can't tell the truth. And his actions prove he's lying. Because if he really meant what he said, he wouldn't be doing what he's doing right now.
Okay.
All right, thanks for the call, Greg. Next, I got Greg in Virginia. Greg, you there?
Hey, hey, Peter, how you doing?
Good.
My question is about gold. I was kind of wondering, how would you spot a bubble in gold? Obviously, nominal price is not going to tell you anything if there's inflation and whatnot. Would you look to other commodities?
Look, it's always hard to know. But I would think that when you get a bubble, right, as opposed to, people say, look, was oil a bubble when it was $150 a barrel? I still don't think it was a bubble. It obviously got ahead of itself, and it obviously had a huge run-up, and then it dropped. But that doesn't mean it was a bubble. Obviously prices got ahead of themselves. I think oil is going to get back above $150 a barrel. I think we're going to take out that high, which will prove then that it really wasn't a bubble because, the high will be eclipsed. But a real bubble is like a mania. It's like an attitude. It's not simply price going up. You can have prices going up without it being a real bubble. So when you're talking about a bubble, you got to think about something like what happened in the real estate market or something that happened in the stock market. When you get this can't lose attitude it seduces the entire country, a huge community of people who, as a group, come to the same conclusion, right, that you can't lose in real estate. Everybody knew that you couldn't lose in real estate. Everybody wanted to own real estate. Everybody was buying real estate. Real estate was all anybody talked about. If you were in a restaurant, if you overheard conversations, it was about houses that somebody bought. Everybody talked about remodeling and doing this and how home ownership was the best investment. You're investing in your future. You have this attitude, and then you get prices that don't reflect reality. They reflect this attitude, and you get all kinds of rationalizations about why these high prices are okay, why rents don't matter. All this nonsense, just like we had with the stock market. So, for there to be some kind of bubble, I think in something like gold, I think you're going to have to see that kind of attitude among people buying gold, that it's almost universally accepted that gold can't lose, that you can't lose money owning gold. It's the only good investment. It'll always go up, and everybody will own it. Your friends will own it. Your coworkers will own it. You'll overhear conversations about it. There'll be gold coin shops sprouting up all over the country, right? It'll be, everybody will be buying it. And if you tell somebody that you want to sell your gold, they'll say, what are you, crazy? Why would you want to sell gold? That is what you're going to have, that kind of, to get a bubble. I think it might happen, but I don't think it's there now. And I think that if prices are going up, it's not because gold is in a bubble if you don't see those things. It's simply because the prices going up.
I'm not thinking it's in a bubble right now. I'm just, in the future.
But, yeah, is it? Those are the signs. If one day, all of your neighbors own gold, if everyone at your office owned gold, if you take a cab ride and the cab driver is telling you you should be buying gold and where the best gold dealers are, then those are good signs that there's a bubble in gold.
Okay, avoid the bubble. How about how would you know what do you look at when you say, okay, gold's not a good buy right now? What other commodities you might, maybe silver or diamonds or anything else?
Well, I think gold is a good buy right now. I think silver is a good buy as well. It makes sense to own them because the key is to get rid of dollars. Dollars are going to go down, that's for sure. And so you want to own something to protect your wealth. Anyway, I didn't realize that it was already got 20 minutes left of the show and I got quite a few people on the line. But anyway, thanks for the call, Greg.
Thanks. Bye.
Let me go to Donovan in Kentucky.
Hi, Peter. Can you hear me?
I've got you.
All right. First of all, I missed you on Freedom Watch today. Hopefully, you'll be back next week.
Yeah, you know, I thought I was supposed to be on the show today. I was actually in the city, and I was going to go by the studio, but for some reason, they didn't want any guests, or they didn't, you know, I don't know, whatever the reason they didn't want me on.
I actually read an interesting piece. I think it was on Bloomberg, but I can't remember who originally published it. That provided an interesting explanation for why the Fed was actually thinking about issuing their own bonds. And the theory is that in order to unravel all of this insanity that the Fed has done by buying up all these mortgages and buying up all these treasuries and so forth, they can't just unwind them by selling them back onto the market because they end up creating the same problems that they have now. So
of course, that's part of the idea that they can take back the liquidity. How are they going to put back into the economy all the toxic assets that they took out of the economy to get it, you know, theoretically to get, not going to be able to put it back in?
Right. Well, the theory is that the magic bullet that they can use is if they issue their own debt instead of reissuing back this debt that they bought, so they can prop up their liability side on their balance sheet, they can try to soak up their own liquidity by paying it back in their own bonds, essentially remasking and acting as a derivatives market for all this crap.
Yeah, well, the whole thing is nonsense, and it would be the equivalent of the Fed issuing more treasuries, because the bonds would basically have, you know, the full faith and credit of the Fed's ability to print, which would basically make them indistinguishable from treasuries. So the whole thing is nonsense.
Yeah, except that I think their theory is that they're wanting to keep the treasury prices low, so if they make their bond prices skyrocket,
and the whole thing is crazy. The Fed is not supposed to issue bonds. The Fed's liabilities are the currency, the Federal Reserve notes, their notes. That's their liability. Their asset is supposed to be the government bonds or gold or whatever they own. They're not supposed to. So basically, right now, the Fed issues short-term liabilities that don't pay interest, right? Currency. What they're saying is we want to issue interest-bearing notes as opposed to the non-interest-bearing notes that we issue now. But the whole thing is crazy.
Yeah,
and there is no way out of this mess.
The other question I have for you is that I heard that China is starting to actually rebuy or re-ramp up their treasury purchases, and I didn't know if you had heard or anything, any rumblings.
I don't know. I haven't heard that. I noticed, interesting, that Goldman Sachs came out today and upped their GDP growth rates for China for the next couple of years. I think by next year they've got China's economy back growing north of 10% again, which is certainly very interesting and supports, you know, what I've been saying about the decoupling and the fact that the Chinese economy can function very well without lending money to Americans to spend. But anyway, I want to try to get through these last calls. So thanks, Sarah, for calling.
Sure, thanks a lot.
All right, let me take no new calls. I'll try to get through the four calls that are on hold because we've got about 15 minutes left. Let me go to Lewis in California.
Hey, Peter, how you doing today?
Okay, how are you, Lewis?
Good, good. Hey, question about your book, Crash Proof. I've read both of them. In Crash Proof, one of your chapters, it says that in 63, the redemption clause is eliminated completely, rendering the U.S. currency intrinsically worthless. But then later on it goes to say that in 71, Nixon closed the gold window. So I don't understand completely how that works.
What happened was there was a period of time where foreigners could get gold for their dollars, but American citizens could not. So while U.S. currency was irredeemable for Americans, it was redeemable for foreigners. Because remember, the reason that the dollar became the world's reserve currency was because it was redeemable in gold. That's how we conned the world to go from a gold standard to a dollar standard, because we told them, look, you know, dollars are as good as gold. You can always get, you know, gold for your dollars. And so we had to preserve that. It wasn't until 1971 that we basically told the foreigners, screw you, we're not going to pay, and we close the gold window. Amazing is that even though we did that, and even though the dollar lost about two-thirds of its value, it continued to serve as a reserve currency, even though it was backed by absolutely nothing.
Right. So we closed the window for U.S. citizens in 63 and closed it to foreigners in 71, pretty much.
In 71 is when, I forget the actual date for Americans. I mean, we stopped. I mean, we took the silver out of our currency. I think in '65 out of the coins, and right. I think you know, and the Federal Reserve notes were still redeemable in silver. I don't think they were redeemable in gold even for Americans at that point, because I don't even think it was even legal for America. I forget when the federal government made it legal again to own gold,
right.
for Americans to own gold.
What do you see as a trigger for these foreign countries to actually be like, you know what, we don't want the dollars as the reserve currency? I mean,
it's already happened. I mean, as I said, I don't think there's going to be an official vote to remove the dollar as the reserve currency, because there's, you know, I think governments, central banks are just going to move away from the dollar on their own. I think the Chinese or Japanese or other countries are just going to not hoard dollars. They're going to start holding other assets like gold or like other metals or other currencies, and the dollar is just going to lose that role, you know, just on its own. It's just going to lose it in the marketplace, because people are going to realize, you know, that there's no sense in having the dollar as a reserve, because the dollar is being perpetually debased and the U.S. economy is a sham.
And
anyway, thanks for the call.
All right, thanks, Peter.
Okay, let me go to Brian, also in California.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for taking
Brian.
The call. Can I ask you two questions?
Mm-hmm.
What are the pros and cons of buying foreign securities on U.S. stock exchanges versus foreign stock exchanges?
Well, the main difference is the liquidity and the cost of trading. So if you want to buy a German stock and you want to buy it in Frankfurt, you know, there's a lot more liquidity there. And the spread between the bid and the ask is going to be much lower, narrower. It'll be very tiny because there's a lot of buyers and sellers. If you try to buy that stock in the United States on the pink sheets, where it probably rarely trades, you may be the only person buying the stock that day, and there's one or two market makers, and you're basically at their mercy, and they basically will say, well, you know, the difference between my bid and my ask could be 10%. So, you know, when you go and you buy the stock in the U.S., you're just going to pay some market maker a huge premium for supplying it to you in U.S. currency on the pink sheets. But if you don't want to spend all that extra money, you know, you can go and trade the stock in Germany in euros and get a much better deal and put the profits that the market maker was going to charge you, you know, in your pocket instead of his. It would be like, you know, if you wanted to buy shares of IBM, you know, would you want to buy them in New York or would you want to buy them, you know, in New Zealand? Now, obviously, if you tried to buy IBM on some pink sheet exchange in New Zealand, you know, when the U.S. market was closed and you went over there and said, hey, I got to buy some IBM right now, you know, you might be able to find someone to sell it to you, but, you know, he might charge a big premium. Whereas if you just went and bought it in New York, you know, you'd get a much better price. And that's how it works. But it's the same stock. You know, so once you've bought the stock, if you buy, you know, a Swedish stock and you buy it, you know, on the pink sheets in the U.S., once you bought it, you own the same stock that as if somebody went to Stockholm and bought it. It's the same company. It's just that you probably paid a lot more to buy it because you bought it through a market maker in the U.S. And then, of course, if you turn around and sell it, you know, you're not going to get as much because, again, you're going to be hitting a bid that's probably a lot lower than the market.
That's probably true on the smaller ones, but I don't know about the bigger ones. I've been buying some Canadian oil trusts.
I mean, you're talking about ADRs. If they have an ADR, right, which is an American Depositary Receipt, and it's actually listed on the New York Stock Exchange or the American Stock Exchange, then that's not going to be the case. There could probably be a lot of volume, and it can be a very fair deal. I thought you were talking about the stocks where they don't have a listed ADR, and you're buying ordinary shares. And the difference between buying the ordinary shares in their home markets versus buying the ordinary shares in the U.S., and there was a big difference. But if the company lists an ADR, generally there's volume in that ADR. I mean, not always. And it's a much fairer price. It's a much smaller spread. But most of the stocks that we like to buy don't have ADR. Some of them do. And where there is an ADR that is liquid, we will buy the stock in the U.S. if it's better for my clients. But most of the stocks that we want to buy, you know, they don't have ADRs, and they never will. Anyway, thanks for the call.
Okay. Well, if it's in the U.S. stock exchange, it's still valued in the foreign currency of that.
No, it just trades in that currency. It doesn't mean it's valued in it. That's just how we transact in it. It doesn't mean that it's if you own a foreign stock even if it trades in the, you're trading in the U.S., you're still out of the dollar, you know. Anyway, I got to hop, though, because I got nine minutes left and just a couple of calls.
Thanks.
All right, let me take Jed in California.
Hi, Peter. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right, thank you very much for taking my call. Got a couple quick questions. I have a lot of student loans, and they're consolidated into several different loans. And since I've been listening to you, in the beginning, I was paying off extra money each month, but now since I've been listening to you, with inflation coming, I've been paying the minimums and putting the rest in GLD. And I'm wondering if it's a good move. Or
what kind of interest rate did you lock in?
I got a couple of different ones. One's at 7, one's at 6.
Yeah. And for how many years do they go?
I think the standard is, like, I think 20 or 25. I'm not
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're better off, you know, keeping the debt and you know, and taking the extra money that you would have used to pay off the debt and buying gold coins with it, or buying, you know, buying dividend-paying foreign stocks where the dividends are higher than 6 or 7%.
Right.
And I do believe one of two things will happen. Either inflation is going to wipe out your student loan debt, or the government's going to pass some kind of bailout and forgive the student loans anyway.
Right, exactly.
You know, and so, and the more loans you have, the more likely it is you'll qualify for some kind of bailout. I mean,
okay,
that's the incentive the government gives you. You know, you want to be as irresponsible as possible, because the more irresponsible you are, the deeper your debts are, right? The more screwed up you are, the more likely you are to qualify for help, because you're more deserving, right? You need it more.
So I should continue probably buying the GLD or whatever.
Well, I would. I would not pay off student loans. That's
okay.
You know, I think there's better things to do with the money, and it's hard to. You could never borrow money that cheap. I mean, you can borrow money a little bit cheaper than 6 or 7% if you're buying a house.
Right.
But other than that, I mean, it's very difficult to get credit for 20 or 30 years at that rate of interest, so I wouldn't pay it off.
And the other quick question was, when this inflation hits, which, after listening to you, I totally agree that's what, will we get raises at our jobs, or if it costs $2,000 for a loaf of bread, where are we going to get
$2,000? Well, look, at some point, yeah, when inflation does get out of control, you will get raises if you still have a job. Because you simply won't work unless your boss gives you a raise. Because it won't be, what's the point? I mean, if inflation is so massive, and, you know, if you're working and let's say you're making $500 a week, and all of a sudden a loaf of bread is $500, you're not going to keep working for $500 a week. So if your boss can't raise your pay, you know, you're going to quit and just make bread on your own. You'll bake it from scratch. So, I mean, obviously, but it's not that everybody's wages are going to go up, you know, in exact proportion to the cost of living. The unfortunate thing that happens in this inflation scenario is wages don't go up as fast as other prices, and a lot of people lose their jobs because the economy is rendered much less efficient. You're wiping out investment, you're wiping out savings, so you have more people that have no income, and the people who do have incomes that are rising, their incomes are not rising as fast as their cost of living, so everybody suffers. It's not like, well, we're all just going to get a raise and it's not going to matter because our wages will go up exactly as much as prices. It's
right.
Not going to work that way.
Okay, thank you very much. I've followed you and your father, and you both are true patriots. I appreciate it.
Great, thanks a lot. Last call of the evening, Tim in Arizona. Thanks for being so patient, Tim.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm actually doing okay. First of all, I want to say thank you for everything that you talk about. You are a true patriot and a real truth teller, and I appreciate that. My question is has to do with two specific things, and they basically are, what are your thoughts on taking physical possession of gold as opposed to vaulting it? And secondly, what are your thoughts on using offshore banking or offshore A accounts for whatever reason or purpose they can be used?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think you should have gold, you know, in as many different locations as possible. I think you should have some gold offshore, like in the Perth Mint, which is what I sell. Gold held, you know, for you in the Perth Mint in Australia, out of the country, where I think it's safe. I think you should have physical gold in your possession, you know, with you in your house, someplace, you know, that you've hidden it someplace. And I wouldn't put it in a safety deposit box. I'm a little bit nervous about that. I'd rather just have it in your possession somewhere. But yeah, I think you need to have you know, gold and silver, no question about that. I mean, you know, I think it's interesting too. I've been looking a lot in the book, the little book. I mentioned, you know, about a need to have you know, to be armed, to have a gun, and to buy ammunition. I actually recommended buying bullets
Oh, I totally agree.
As an investment, because I thought their value would go up, and now I'm reading articles about how the best investments so far in 2009 is ammunition. That prices are doubling and tripling, and you go into ammo stores and you can't even get any because it's all gone.
Absolutely.
But I think it's
Absolutely.
Important that you do things in advance, because if you wait too long, you know, you won't be able to buy a lot of the things.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the second part of your question?
The second part was, what are your thoughts on using offshore accounts or offshore banking?
You know, I don't deal in that. I mean, I certainly think there is a compelling argument why you would want to have an offshore account, why you would want to have more than just your gold offshore, which I can help you with. And I think that makes sense to have gold offshore. But, you know, would it make sense to have foreign bank accounts or to have trusts offshore where you owned foreign assets in those accounts? Certainly. I mean, if you're fearful of the U.S. government confiscating your wealth, it's a lot more difficult for them to confiscate it if it's not here. Mm-hmm. But that's something that, you know, I don't work with, and I don't help people do that. They just need to do that on their own. Now, mm-hmm. I mean, certainly somebody can have an account with Euro Pacific Capital. They can have foreign stocks that I've purchased for them. And at some point in the time, if they do end up opening up a foreign offshore account, there's nothing that stops them from transferring those stocks from their domestic account to their foreign account. But, you know, it's something that people who feel they want to go that route need to explore it on their own. The U.S. government or, you know, the FINRA or SEC would not be very happy with me if I were to actively help people doing that. They might try to look at that as a reason to shut me down for money laundering or some violation of the Patriot Act. Mm. That's just the kind of country we live in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Pete, time sure flies. Thanks for taking my call, and have a nice day, okay?
Hey, thanks for calling. Yep, time does fly. We got about 2 minutes left of the show. As I said, I'll be back next week after I get back from Florida. I'm not sure. Let me see what else I've got on my scheduled appearances. I know I'm going to be doing the New York Hard Asset Conference, which is open to the public. That's May 11th and 12th in New York, so that's if you're in the New York area. Also, if you're in the New York area, I am speaking at this End the Fed rally in a park in New York this Saturday. So if you're living in the New York area and you want to, this is a big march and a rally about putting an end to the Fed. So I'm doing that on Saturday. Anyway, that's it. Don't forget to buy, you know, Crash Proof and a little book. By the way, I just finished the revision of Crash Proof 2.0, and I think it's going to come out in September. I was used to thought it was October, but it's coming out now in September. So Crash Proof 2.0 will be available, but before, you know, you can still buy Crash Proof 1 and the Little Book of Bull Moves and Bear Markets. Make sure to call up and open up an account if you haven't already called Euro Pacific Capital to get your account set up. 800-727-7922. The foreign markets have been performing very well. I mean, they continue to perform better than the U.S. market. The dollar has not, you know, made a substantial drop yet, but it is no longer rising, and it seems to be trending lower, and it seems to be looking toppy. Meanwhile, you know, foreign markets, particularly in the Asian economies, and a lot of the resource stocks have certainly turned around and are doing a lot better. Anyway, again, it's 800-727-7922. Thanks for listening. I will be back again next week with another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. Thank you.